Welcome to the Jazz Legends Podcast, which was born out of the Jazz Evensong gatherings on Sunday nights at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. Saxophonist composer Joe Henderson, born April 24, 1937, was an eclectic performer, recording over 30 albums on Blue Note Records, ranging from straight-ahead sessions with Horace Silver to more avant-garde outings with Andrew Hill, always sounding like himself in every setting. He recorded with Herbie Hancock and even spent a period of time with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. The knowledgeable jazz musicians you'll hear are Gunnar Biggs, Keith Bishop, Joey Carano, and Bob Weller. And the talk is moderated by me, your host, Father Doran Stambaugh. Dig it. One of the things I left out in the intro is the seminal recordings that he made with trumpeter Kenny Dorman in the 1960s, many of which you guys are going to be playing.
Dorham.
Kenny Dorham. Yeah. I said Doorman.
Doorman.
Yeah, yeah. Bob Doorman.
Kenny the Doorman.
Kenny Dorham in the 1960s. Who wants to start off sharing a little bit about
Joe? I'm guessing Keith
the tenor,
about the tenor player.
He's one of the last saxophone players that really had his own personal sound, I think, of the, coming up. That years ago, everybody was immediately identifiable, partly because nobody really had learned a schooled approach to playing the saxophone and figured out on their own how to make a noise on the thing. So they all had their own distinctive sounds, like Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young. And all those guys had such personal sounds that you could tell it was them immediately from playing a couple notes. And that's the way Joe Henderson's sound was. He really had his own personal sound and rhythmic approach to playing the instrument. And that's part of what I find so attractive about his playing, besides the fact that he was such a wonderful composer. He wrote so many really great tunes that have become jazz standards over the years. And he had such a long career as a player, which was also contributing to how much I enjoy what he does. I'm particularly enamored with the band that he had with Kenny Dorham in the 60s. They made 5 records on Blue Note, and about every tune on every record has become a jazz standard. And Kenny Dorham is one of the great underrated jazz musicians of all time, in my estimation. And I think that some of his best work is the band that he had with Joe Henderson. It's ironic, Joe Henderson had kind of a resurgence in his career a few years before he passed away. He got signed with Verve Records, and one of the first records he made was with Wynton Marsalis, and it got rave reviews from all these critics. And Kenny and Joe Henderson was vocal enough about it when people would interview him about it and say, well, why didn't anyone care about this great band I had with Kenny Dorham in the 60s? Like, we played all this great music and he was such a great player, and because all of a sudden I'm making a record with Marsalis, everybody thinks it's great. Like, bullshit, basically. Yeah. And I had to give him credit for, like, coming out and saying that, because it was true. You know, they all of a sudden acted like they just discovered this great Joe Henderson. And he's like, I've been playing, like, for 50 years now. Like, what's going on? And all of a sudden, like, people discovered me. Like, I don't get it. And I think he was justified in saying that, because I used to sing everywhere in these little clubs and stuff, sometimes playing with local rhythm sections. And he was just like a jazz journeyman. Like, he wouldn't go anywhere and play with anybody. And all of a sudden, like, they discovered him, and he's like a jazz star. And it's like, well, I've been playing this way for the last, my whole life, and all of a sudden I've been discovered. Oh, that's nice, you know. Like, of course, he died a few years after that. But
what does that say something about those decades too? And I don't know if it does, but the scene in 1960 versus 1980?
Well, partially the fact that he ended up touring with Blood, Sweat, and Tears for a minute speaks something about his career, because here's this great jazz musician that's played with everybody, and all of a sudden he's playing with like a rock pop act. Not that it's a bad rock pop act, but
yeah.
It was after Blood, Sweat, and Tears had been a successful, like, marketable rock and roll band. He played with them for a while. And I have to give them credit that they, like, interested in having Joe Henderson play with them, although I don't know that anyone knew who he was that went to see that band when he was playing with them. But
right. So in 1960s, he was lesser known.
He was always playing, and he was always recording. He's on so many records, it's ridiculous. And over the years, he continued to have a career as a recording artist. But he thought it was, I think, ironic that all of a sudden in the late stages of his career, when he started recording on Verve Records and they marketed the things, that people discovered him all of a sudden. Hey, have you heard Joe Henderson? Like, yeah, well, Joe Henderson's been around forever. Like, aren't you hip to him? You know? And I think that was part of his, like, what he had to say about it, when all of a sudden they acted like he was a newly discovered giant jazz players. Like, I've been around all this time. I've written all this music. Like, nobody's given a shit up till now.
What's going on?
Well, Wynton became almost an overnight, like, household name, too, because he made a big splash. And, he played with Wynton.
And they marketed Wynton to the up the wazoo, and
right.
It was like all of a sudden the Joe Henderson got associated with Wynton. I think he kind of resented that himself, because I don't think he thought Wynton was all that, especially after playing on all those records with Kenny Dorham, who was all that. You know, I had a friend that went in to buy a trumpet at Manny's Music years ago before they went out of business, and Kenny Dorham was working as a warehouse guy at Manny's Music. And he heard my friend like warming up. He says, "Oh, that sounds pretty good." And it's like Kenny Dorham. What are you doing? Like moving crates. Well, that's such is the music business.
That's true, yeah.
Were you about to say something? And then he also played with Freddie Hubbard a lot. And they're the trumpet player that was so interesting, who I actually thought was older than Freddie Hubbard, but I heard
Lee Morgan?
No.
Played with Woody Shaw.
Woody Shaw, that's
one of my favorite records is Unity with Larry Young and Woody Shaw and Joe Henderson and Elvin, which is one of the great unknown records, I think, of all time.
What's that called?
It's called Unity.
And Larry Young.
I think I bought my copy for 99 cents in a drugstore. It was a cutout mono when Blue Note was getting rid of all their mono LPs, like the Dark Ages. And I've worn out a couple copies of that. I have a CD copy of it now, but every tune on that is great, and Joe just plays so well.
Mm-hmm. And Larry Young
is
awesome.
Also one of the great unknown organ players.
Well, and I was surprised because I heard a semi-interview of Freddie Hubbard, and he was talking about two young trumpet players. And I always thought Woody Shaw was a little older than Freddie Hubbard, but I'm wrong. Yeah.
And he died tragically,
because he talked about him, and he said, he's a great trumpet player.
But they recorded together,
too. I know they did,
But Woody Shaw was kind of a tragic figure.
Hmm. Didn't he lose an arm in a subway accident?
Well, they think he tried to kill himself by throwing himself in front of a subway train. And it didn't kill him, but he did lose an arm. And I saw him several years before he passed away in Germany, and he was blind. Mm-hmm. They had to lead him up onto the bandstand. Wow. And after he got up there, it was like scary with what he could play. But and I used to see him around New York. Lou Soloff used to take him out to clubs. I saw him at the Vanguard several times, and Lou would lead him in, and they'd sit down and check out the music. And there's Woody Shaw. You know, like, he was really something.
There's an article here on Joe Henderson from Downbeat, and he describes his approach to the music, and he says, "I've always wanted to be the best interpreter the world has ever seen. Where a precocious youngster gets an idea like that is beyond me, but somehow improvisation set in on me pretty early." And earlier in the article, he talks about all the records that he grew up listening to, Lester Young, Stan Getz, Charlie Parker. So speaking of that thing of that getting inside you as a young person and how that would affect you, we were talking about that earlier. But he says, "I've always tried to recreate melodies even better than the composers who wrote them. I've always tried to come up with something that never even occurred to them. This is the challenge, not to rearrange the intentions of the composers, but to stay within the parameters of what the composers have in mind and be creative and imaginative and meaningful." I mean, I can only barely conceptualize what that means as a musician of his caliber, or your guys' caliber, where you want to stay in the parameters of the melody that a composer has written, but also try to, I don't know, creatively make it as good as it could be. Like, I can only kind of grasp what that means. But for me, it speaks to his drive to be as original and creative as possible, which is what I feel like I hear you saying, Keith, in your intro about how he has his own.
And we should also mention he came out of Toledo and grew up in the Detroit scene when all those guys were playing there too. So that was an influence on him too. And I don't think anybody put up with any nonsense in Detroit. If you came up on the bandstand, you better be able to play.
Right.
And that was part of the scene that those guys all developed in. And I think it was a very positive thing. There's so many original voices that came out of that town playing this music. And he's definitely one of them.
And then he ended up in San Francisco. So talk about a contrast.
Well, from what I'd surmised, it was partially to get out of the drug culture in New York that he decided to go to San Francisco.
I love that record of McCoy Tyner's The Real McCoy. I think we've talked about that song before, but that one just kills me still.
Yeah, Joe is on so many seminal jazz records as a sideman, besides being a leader and writing all that material that he wrote for those bands that he had with Kenny Dorham. And all the other bands that he had. He had a band for a long time with Curtis Fuller and this alto player from New York. Oh, drawing a blank on his name. But it was an interesting instrumentation, too, that he chose. Because more often than not, you'd have a quintet with a trumpet and a tenor. And for a period of time, he had a band that had Pete Yellen was the alto player, and himself and Curtis Fuller. And that's an interesting concept, just to write for those three horns, which was different than most people would have chosen at that time. But that's, he had an original voice, he wrote original music, and he chose like some interesting combinations of musicians to play with, too.
He played with everybody. I mean, I'm looking at his discography, he passed it around. You know, Kenny Dorham's pretty much...
For a period of time.
But I mean, he has a different bass player, drummer, piano player. Almost every album is just a different lineup, and but they're all great.
For a period of time, I guess in the 80s, he had like an all-female rhythm section too, which was completely bizarre for, you know, but he realized that these women could really play and he featured them.
I remember when there was that push for him, that Verve thing that happened, I guess, late 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
And they had a bunch of records that were well-packaged and there was a lot of support for him. And then he traveled with a tour, the Kansas City something tour, where they had a big band, the Kansas City Big Band, which was playing the music from a movie called Kansas City, which is directed by the guy who did MASH. And
there were a lot of jazz players in that movie.
Right. What's the director's name?
It's an odd movie. I can't remember now what it was called.
I thought it was called Kansas City. Robert Altman, thank you.
Yeah.
Really interesting director, I think. But so there was that band, and there was a quartet, a Charlie Hayden quartet. And Joe Henderson, who was traveling with a trio, so pianoless trio, and his playing is brilliant. I mean, I would actually prefer to hear him in that situation. But I think for most, it was dry. You know.
He made two records on Blue Note just right at the end before he switched to the Verve contract, Nights at the Vanguard with just bass and drums. And he also made a really wonderful record on Red Records, which he had an Italian label that he was under contract for a while, a trio record with them. And it really gives him really complete harmonic freedom to just play with the bass player.
He has it all, you know.
Oh, yeah, he definitely did.
And so I love to hear him in that scenario personally, but I'm not sure how the crowd was digging it. It was a big show. Lots of people were there, but of course, you know, 30 musicians ended up playing that night.
Yeah. Well, judging by most of the people that were on that Altman movie, he was one of the more adventuresome of that crew, I would think. So if the crowd went to see like some of the guys that were playing on that soundtrack, they wouldn't really be into what Joe Henderson was into, I wouldn't think, so much.
Because it was mostly kind of retro. Yeah,
kind of retro. And a lot of the players that they used in that film were sort of trying to harken back to that
honking and
era.
Screaming.
And Joe Henderson definitely wasn't looking backwards.
Yeah. And he used to come to San Diego fairly often. I heard him up at Alario's, and that was great. And there was a place called The Loft where I heard him play, and that was awesome. Although it was a funny rhythm section that time around, and he would play a lot of the same songs, and I remember folks criticizing him, and I heard him talk about it where, you know, I'm traveling from city to city playing with different rhythm sections. We're finding some common ground with Blue Bossa. Everyone knows it, and it's a vehicle for us to listen to one another and hopefully find something new, which makes sense because his playing, he was one of my favorites. I love Joe Henderson's playing.
I always kind of felt sorry for guys like that. I used to see Sonny Stitt with all these local rhythm sections everywhere, and I thought, what a lonely life to go out on the road by yourself and have to deal with sometimes good rhythm sections, sometimes awful rhythm sections, and try and play your best in all these different situations. And Joe Henderson, most of the time when I would hear him, it would be in bigger towns, so it would have better rhythm sections. But I know he spent a lot of time with inferior rhythm sections, I'm sure.
He was playing a trio down at that hotel downtown. What's the name of that hotel?
Horton Grand.
He was there, and he was with Al Foster. And I forget who the bass player was, but it was just a trio.
That was probably burning, though.
It was great. Oh, yeah. It was fantastic. But, no piano player.
What do you like about his playing that you mentioned that you like?
Well, it's funny. In that interview, he talks about paying special attention to the composer's intention. For me, he would just go haywire. He'd flip everything up and down, and he was virtuoso. His time feel was great. His sound was different than other saxophone players. I mean, maybe it was not open, except he would get right up on the microphone.
He had such a real big tenor sound.
A light way of playing.
Yeah.
But again, his time was so interesting, and harmonically, he was so agile in that he can seemingly go in any direction. You know, like we hear about Charlie Parker, folks talk about Charlie Parker. It just seemed to me that he can go any which way, and I find his playing very exciting every time I hear him still.
His time concept was interesting because he could slip and lay way back at the time and all of a sudden just like land on one. And it was kind of exciting that way because you think, how's he going to pull this off? And he does. It's like a high wire act sometimes.
And a sense of swing. We were talking about swinging earlier. It was, to me, it was just different because it seemed so light. And maybe that's because the mic was right in his bell and he didn't need to dig in like you might hear a Joe Lovano or one of those swinging players.
He had his own sound and his own conception of playing the saxophone. And part of it was he didn't play like with a real huge sound or real strong sound.
And he had his own things. He had his own little licks that were not John Coltrane's and were not Charlie Parker's. So,
you could tell that he'd listened to all those guys, but he definitely had his own take on
And I always thought it was interesting that because I've heard him talk about Stan Getz.
Stan Getz was a big influence.
I know, and I thought that was interesting. You know,
well, you know what so John different. Coltrane said about Stan Getz? If we could, we'd all try and sound like Stan Getz.
Yeah.
Apparently, Junior Cook and Joe Henderson were very close when they were in the service together, and they were big influence on each other. Junior Cook's another guy you don't hear about very much.
Right.
Has anybody else seen Joe Henderson? Has everybody seen Joe Henderson play?
Just one time?
Yeah. Just once here. And it was a chordless trio. That's a hard trio to make happen, especially for bass players. Mm. You know, no, I'm serious.
You say that as a bass player.
Well, yeah, I do. The first time I did it was with a really great tenor player in Minneapolis and a drummer. And I was terrified, you know, because the freedom that it gives the tenor player is incumbent upon how well the drummer and I lay a fabric underneath that can retain harmonic rhythm.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit restrictive to the bass player. You can't go too far afield because you are kind of holding the harmonic. But a great tenor player will be outlining the harmonies such that if you play along with the tenor player, you're going to be pretty safe. But you have to live together with a trio like that for a while. You got to just...
I remember Art Farmer being quoted as saying when he first joined Jerry Mulligan's pianoless group, it scared the crap out of him because he wasn't used to just having all that space and being able to fill it. I guess after a while he got used to it.
But. Well, that's what this tenor player said. It's like, I just love not having the guy say, this is a minor 7 flat.
Well, that's why Sonny Rollins did it as much as he did.
Yeah.
And he made some amazing records just with bass and drums. But it's a different thing for the bass player and drummer to.
Yeah,
it's a big responsibility to do that.
It was fun after I got used to it, but the first couple of gigs were like, whoa!
I really do like those records of Sonny Rollins and Joe Henderson in the pianoless trio, and then Mark Turner did it with that band Fly, and I think those records are really good.
Yeah, Mark Turner is an interesting character. You know, we were talking about Lenny Tristano, and it sounds like he's coming out of that bag way more than like some of the other players of his generation.
I think so, too.
And interestingly enough, I think John Coltrane's son sounds like he's coming out of Warren Marsh a lot more than he's coming out of his dad.
Hmm. They're talking about Robbie Coltrane?
Yeah, Robbie. When I've heard him, he sounds so much like he's into Warren Marsh more than John Coltrane, which surprised me.
I did hear Joe Henderson also talk about Lee Konitz in something recently, which I thought was interesting.
If I was Coltrane's kid, I wouldn't want to try to sound like Coltrane.
Yeah, I mean, tell me about it, yeah.
You'd want to make your own statement.
You'd want to sound like
Here's another quote from Joe Henderson. And this is a theme that I keep finding throughout jazz and jazz history, that theme of receiving, you know, what you receive from the guys that came before you and then wanting to share it with the guys that come after and to kind of keep the tradition going. So I love hearing these guys repeat this theme. But he says, I think this is part of it, to present some of the youngsters with one of the more established voices. This is the natural way that it happens. This is the way that it happened for me. I wouldn't have met the people I met if it hadn't been for Kenny Dorham, Horace Silver, Miles Davis, people I've been on the bandstand with. They introduced me to their audiences. We have to do things like this. When older musicians like me find people who can continue the tradition, there, I use the word tradition, we have to create ways to bring these people to the fore.
Now, I remember reading that one of the first people he met when he moved to New York was Kenny Dorham. And Kenny Dorham, like, opened up a whole world for him of all the New York musicians that Kenny knew that Joe didn't know yet. So, and it's a continuum. It's also interesting, like, talking about the tradition, when he, one of the last records he made for Verve was all Billy Strayhorn compositions. And I saw him interviewed about it. And he said, the thing about Billy Strayhorn is the songs are so complete and so interesting that you don't have to do anything to change them. And like, the way he wrote it is the way you have to play it. And, you know, there's so many possibilities with the harmonies that he wrote and everything that it's just incredible.
He loved
Billy Strayhorn's music.
That's one of the quotes I highlighted. He says, you don't have to do anything but play the melody and people will be pleased. One of the songs like that is Lush Life. That's, for me, the most beautiful tune ever written. It's even more profound knowing that Billy Strayhorn wrote it, words and music, when he was 17 or 18. How does an 18-year-old arrive at that point of feeling that depth? Musicians have to plant some trees and replant some trees to extend the life of these good things. Billy Strayhorn was one of the people whose talent should be known. It's interesting to me about, I mean, reading, I don't know Joe Henderson much at all. I'm excited to go listen to more of his stuff, but he sounds like a really unique, original voice who loves playing other people's music and even trying to make it as good as it can be. But he also is his own, composer, and he's written his own tunes as well.
Yeah. And you can tell he has a respect for the tradition, the way he writes. It's always a little bit left of center of the stuff that's come before, but it's coming out of the tradition and extending that tradition, which is, I think, part of the reason I like his playing so much.
Yeah.
Because he came up at a time that there were an awful lot of people that were embracing the avant-garde and just, they didn't really have any depth to their playing. It was just like flailing away. And especially in the records he made, the avant-garde piano player.
Andrew Hill.
He was trying to stretch the envelope. And when Joe plays with him, you can still tell where he's coming from, but he's trying to play more on avant-garde style. But he still has roots in his playing, which a lot of those guys that played in that setting in the 60s didn't have.
Some of the tunes that you guys will play are?
Well, we're going to play Record a May, which is one of his well-known tunes.
Which he supposedly wrote when he was, what, 15?
Yeah, supposedly. Yeah. And we're going to play Isotope.
Inner Urge.
We're going to play Inner Urge. Probably most of these tunes you've never heard of. Most of the audience will have never heard them. But I think they're accessible because, like I said, they're all coming out of the tradition that Joe Henderson is coming out of.
Yeah.
And I can't play anything like Joe Henderson.
Black Narcissus, maybe?
I'm sorry?
Black Narcissus.
Black Narcissus is one of my favorites that he wrote, you know.
You say you can't play anything, you can't play like Joe?
I can't play like Joe Henderson. I don't know anybody but Rich Perry that can play like Joe Henderson. And when Rich Perry went to take a lesson from Joe Henderson, Joe Henderson says, you sound a lot like me. Don't. And I think Rich Perry's kind of taken that to heart because on his early records, you could really tell he'd listened a lot of Joe Henderson and was trying to emulate Joe Henderson. And I heard him a few months ago when we were in upstate New York, and he still plays great, but it's not as much in the Joe Henderson as it was. He's found his own voice, I think, since then.
Be yourself. Yeah, that's the message.
And that's sort of what he was saying in some of those interviews, too. Yeah. Like, don't try and ape anybody in particular. Like, go on your own.
Yeah.
Find your own voice.
Yeah.
And it's hard when you're coming up and you're like so enamored with somebody's playing that you want to learn everything that they did and try and sound like that. But at some point you have to go out and find something else to latch on to.
I would think that's the trick, right? Because you got to learn. You got to learn somehow. You learn by playing other stuff. But then
I think you have to emulate. I think anybody that's worth his salt has emulated the people that came before him. But as Lester Young used to say, you don't want to sound like a repeater pencil. Hmm. And people were aping him. He was very, very upset with Stan Getz's career path, that Stan Getz was making a lot more money sounding like him than he was making.
Oh, right.
Which is kind of ironic.
I won't go find it, but Joe Henderson, he does go on to say, like, I hear myself in other people's playing, and then I'll hear them interviewed, and they won't credit it, and that kind of sucks. Like, that bugs me. And he seems very open about wanting to credit all the musicians that he loves and trying to play their music, but be his own voice within that. And so, yeah, if you're gonna go ahead and, you know, use somebody else's style or licks or whatever, at least own it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Another one of the last records he made on Verve was a Bossa Nova record, and it was sort of an open homage to Stan Getz, but he did it his own way.
Yeah.
You have to give him credit for
an original.
Credit's due, although he was very open about his admiration for Stan Getz.
Mm-hmm. As he should be. The weekly Jazz Evensong gatherings are free and open to the public and take place Sundays at 4 p.m. at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. See you there.